The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
In that group of people 60 to 74 with maybe COPD or something like that, risk for RSV hospitalization was reduced with getting a vaccine. So we still kind of saw that benefit there.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Efficacy, Comparative Effectiveness, and Harm of Respiratory Syncytial Virus Vaccines in Adults Who Are Not Pregnant or Immunocompromised, a Rapid Review for the American College of Physicians. Joining us on the podcast is Dr. Rachel Lee, who is Professor of Infectious Disease and the UAB Chief Healthcare Epidemiologist. We hope that this will help you understand the benefits of RSV vaccine and the concerns about the disease RSV, especially in patients who are at great risk because of age or because of COPD. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I'm very excited to have this conversation about RSV. We'll start out with a story. Fairly recently, I had a 75-year-old man with COPD who, on admission to the hospital, was found to have RSV as the cause of his COPD exacerbation. I saw him for the first time on the third day, and by that time, his PCO2 was way up. He was using accessory muscles. He could hardly talk to us. Transferred him to the unit. He had a good outcome, but he was quite sick for about a week. I wondered, in my 50 years of internal medicine, how many cases of RSV I missed before we did viral testing. But it really brought home to me the seriousness of RSV. And maybe you could expand on that and talk about the benefits of having a vaccine for RSV.
Yeah, I think your patient really highlights what we have learned kind of, you know, over time, especially when we have these multiplex PCR tests that are done as soon as someone has a, you know, some sort of viral respiratory illness. So, you know, RSV, as you have said, is not just a pediatric illness. It is an RNA virus. It's spread through respiratory droplets. Incubation period is about 4 to 6 days. And so the symptoms can be quite different depending on the patient. So it can be anything from a mild acute respiratory infection to like a lower respiratory tract infection that requires respiratory support, as in your case. What's interesting, like, so in kids, it is the most common pathogen causing lower respiratory tract infections. It is the second leading cause of infant deaths worldwide. And so I think we forget about that global context. In the United States, the incidence of RSV-related hospitalization in kids less than 5 is about 2.9 cases per 1,000 per year. But in infants younger than 6 months, the incidence is much higher. So we know that the incidence is high. We see kind of people who are at highest burden of this are infants and adults over the age of 70. And then we can also include our high-risk populations that we kind of saw with COVID-19. So chronic cardiovascular disease, chronic lung disease, end-stage renal disease, and of course, moderate to severe immunocompromising illnesses. So why are we even here talking about vaccination? Well, the fact is that we really don't have very many treatments at all or specific antiviral therapy for infection. All we really have is symptomatic treatment, which is what happened in your case. And so these vaccines are developed because RSV really has a true burden in older adults.
And as you said, in infants also. So, and we'll touch that here in a few minutes. But let's talk about why we don't give RSV vaccine to everybody. Why the committee looked at, as you pointed out, the people who are at risk, and why do we not just take the average 45-year-old man or woman who's coming in and wants to be vaccinated for viral infections? We're not recommending it for those people. Why?
Yeah, I think the committee did a really great job trying to tease out the risks and benefits of getting these vaccines. And so, since 2023, there are currently three vaccines available. Two are kind of your standard protein subunit vaccines, and one's an mRNA vaccine. And the FDA approval is for anybody over the age of 60 or adults 18 through 59 with increased risk of lower respiratory tract infection. And so the question then became from the committee is, for adults over the age of 18, what is the benefit? And so the first practice point is really clear. Age over 75 or older should receive a protein subunit RSV vaccine. And that's because they scoured all of the different levels of evidence that are out there. And they found that RSV vaccines reduce the risk of RSV-related hospitalization significantly. So 23 fewer people getting hospitalized and 128 fewer people per 100,000 just for one RSV season. Now, we're getting more data as we get two RSV seasons, et cetera. And so those numbers continue to kind of build over time. So RSV-related hospitalization, and then really the data was kind of insufficient about severe adverse events, but really not too many that they found. I think the biggest concern, of course, is Guillain-Barré. But in these large kind of population-based studies, the incidence was kind of the same as outside of those who received the vaccine. So then, if we kind of like tease a little bit further, practice point two is for that kind of 60 to 74-year-old range who are at increased risk of RSV should consider getting that. And so, similar to that, one randomized controlled trial that found that in that group of people 60 to 74 with maybe COPD or something like that, the risk for RSV hospitalization was reduced with getting a vaccine. So we still kind of saw that benefit there.
I think it's important because we're concerned about the infants, even though we're internists, that in this study they specifically talk about pregnant women. Do they particularly talk about people who have young kids? As a grandfather, if I was going to visit my grandson when he was a baby, is it important for me to have an RSV vaccine to protect the baby? It's important for
Yeah.
pregnant women to get an RSV vaccine to protect the baby.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think for us it's the other way around. Like you would be at risk of getting RSV from your grandkids and potentially the other way around. I mean, we work in a hospital, right? But luckily, we're pretty in tune with people that are coming in with respiratory infections. I think, if you go into the supplement of the article, it's really interesting to think about like classic infectious disease math, like where we're trying to find and fine-tune the risks and benefit of who should get a vaccine. And so like when you take epidemiologic data and apply it, that's when we really start seeing some of this like huge benefit in age over 75, that is just, it stands alone and is apart from everything. But in that 60 to 74-year-old range, with an increased risk, you still see that benefit, but it's much harder. So it's really easy for us to say if you're 82 and you have COPD, yeah, the benefit is very clear. But if you're 62 and otherwise healthy, maybe that benefit is nuanced. And, if I were your physician, we would kind of talk through those risks and benefits together. And come to a decision together about getting the vaccine.
But if it was 62 with significant COPD,
Oh yeah, clear.
you'd be making a strong recommendation.
I would make a strong yes. Yeah. But I will admit I'm very pro-vaccine because as we talked about in this case, that we don't have much and we've all been through that COVID-19 pandemic where it was just heartbreaking to not be able to offer much other than oxygen and kind of TLC more than anything.
So that's really a worthwhile thing. The people who get RSV compared to influenza, that was really interesting when I started reading about that, because we don't think twice about the importance of influenza vaccines. At least you and I don't think twice about that. When RSV vaccine first came out, I was says, do I, is this something that I'm going to really need? I wasn't quite 75 then. I waited till after I was 75 to get the vaccine, and I did get it. But why am I telling all my friends to get it? Maybe you could talk about that compared to influenza.
Yeah, and I think, this highlights, what we've kind of continued to learn over the years. So if we go back in influenza, we have had influenza vaccination for quite some time. And then when H1N1 hit, I think in 2009, we saw significant impact on pregnant moms and kind of those early, who we wouldn't classically think would be having those kind of issues. And so from that, we've been able to kind of whittle down on our data and say, like, look, these people are at an increased risk. So we have years of experience there. Similarly, with COVID-19, we had a lot of experience because we were all hit with COVID-19 at the same time. And so a lot of epidemiologic data to really help us understand how do these vaccines help. But as you kind of brought up earlier, we haven't been really testing everybody for RSV until more recently. And so I think we're starting to truly understand that burden and the impact. And I think, we have we're talking here in internal medicine, but we've got our colleagues in OBGYN that have really good data that shows giving a maternal RSV vaccination, so while mom is pregnant, shows substantial protection against severe RSV disease in infants. So 82% reduction at 90 days. And so that's that pocket of other at-risk individuals that they're really trying to improve. So if we can reduce the burden to most groups, then that's the goal of vaccination.
So the other thing that I think it was important for me to learn, because I was inexperienced with RSV until I had this patient, and I suspect that some of my colleagues listening to this podcast have not known that they were taking care of RSV before. When you have a patient with RSV, what are the and as an ID consultant, what are the things that you're looking for that give the red flags that make you very nervous?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, when I think one of our lessons learned is that a viral pneumonia is not benign, right? It can be just as bad as a bacterial pneumonia and can lead to going to the intensive care unit. So, the red flags I think about, so I think about the disease, right? But then I also think about the patient. So, if you have a patient with COPD that doesn't have much reserve, they may potentially tip over much quicker than someone who is otherwise young and healthy. So things I look for, of course, are symptoms like worsening hypoxemia, increased oxygen requirement, increased work of breathing. So if they're using those accessory muscles, if they're altered in any sort of way, which can be difficult to tease out in some patients, hemodynamic instability, and of course, decompensation of an underlying disease. If you see acute kidney injury, maybe they're dehydrated, all those other things. And all of that together to me is how I describe not passing the eyeball test. And it sounds like you kind of had that similar, like, oh, this person's not passing the eyeball test. We've got to do something different.
Oh, I walked in the room, and my spidey sense was, this guy needs to be in the unit, which we all learn that while we're residents. That there's certain patients that just scare you, and you've described it really nicely. You did mention that some people have tried antivirals. I suspect that they're not very good antiviral studies yet. Does anything work, or do we give it hoping it works?
Yeah. So the one medication that has been studied or has maybe shown some potential benefit was ribavirin, but when they looked across big broad populations, there was really nothing that kind of stuck with that, with the exception of stem cell transplant. and hematologic malignancy, there potentially is a benefit in that very, very small group. It is obviously not a benign drug. It's got a lot of side effects, and the inhaled ribavirin is actually very difficult to give in the hospital setting.
Are there, other than COPD, are there other patient groups that we probably should be thinking about a little bit more aggressively, perhaps in the 60s, and between 60 and 74? Who else should we worry about that seems to do not as well with RSV?
Yeah, I think our immunocompromised patients are a bit difficult to tease out. That is probably one of the largest growing populations in the United States. We have all of our biologics now, a lot of newer medications that are adjuvants to maybe chemotherapy that are very specific to the certain antibody that they're or stem cell that they're attacking. So that group in and of itself, if what I tell my residents, like, hey, if they've got a blah 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 mab, like go look it up and try to understand whatever the how the pathway that it's working on, so you can see if your patient is at a higher risk of something like RSV.
And is heart failure an issue?
Yes, I would say so. And I think you play that difficult balance in a patient that comes in with an infection that potentially is dehydrated, but it takes very little fluids to kind of put them back into being volume overloaded. So I would say yes, I would be concerned about that group.
Okay, and since there's so much diabetes, and diabetes is sort of a immunocompromise, especially type 2 diabetes, are you more aggressive about treating them? And does the paper focus at all on that group?
Yeah, so I think so. Yes, to answer your question, diabetes is included in that. Obesity is included. Chronic kidney disease. Pretty much all the things that we see in high amounts here in the Southeast is are all kind of risk factors. I tend to tease it out a little bit more. So if you have a type 2 diabetic whose A1C is less than 7%, they're probably not as high of a risk as, say, an A1C that is, 9, 10%. That shows that they are potentially at risk for tipping over.
Great. Well, I think this has been really useful. I find it interesting after all these years, I'm learning about infections that I ne didn't never really learned a lot about, and you've really helped me understand where we are now, and I think we probably should be much more aggressive, especially in the COPD patients at risk, and especially in my peers over 75. So thank you, Rachel, so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This interesting discussion was unique in that we focused on who needs RSV, but also who does not need RSV vaccine. It's not necessary for everyone. It's definitely worthwhile for those of us who are over 75, but if you're healthy and under 75, it's not necessary. It's FDA approved over the age of 60, and we should consider in people who are immunocompromised and especially people who have COPD. Finally, if you happen to take care of women who become pregnant, if they have not had their vaccine, vaccinating them protects their infants when they deliver. We hope that you learned a bit about the dangers of RSV, who to get vaccinated, and when to worry when someone is admitted with RSV. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.